Last week, we talked about the right for people to exist. But what about groups of people, nations, countries?
And what makes people so special to begin with?
What about beings other than people?
The Right to Exist, Part 2, right now.
Philosophers.
Philosophers.
Well, I guess we're back on a Part 2.
Is this the... No, it's the second time ever where we said we were going to do something next week and actually did it.
I know. We're growing up. So a quick recap. What did we talk about last week?
Last week, we began talking about the concept of the right to exist. And we discussed how this applied to people. Do people have a right to exist?
Mm-hmm.
And we determined that basically, yes.
But this week, we want to talk a little bit about entities we kind of treat like people sometimes. We often represent them as a single person, but they're not. They're groups.
Mm-hmm.
Broadly speaking, we're going to talk about nations.
Yes.
And a nation's right to exist or not. So, what do you think about when I say, or when you hear someone say, X nation has a right to exist or doesn't have a right to exist? Because depending on the nation, there are groups of people who may have differing opinions about its right to exist or not.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about when you hear that?
My mind goes to a couple of different places.
Usually the Middle East, but go on.
Usually, yes.
Go on.
It does tend to be where all the messiness happens.
Or Southern Europe. There's a lot of that there, too.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, there's like, what, Czechoslovakia broke up. There's the Croatia, Serbia. In recent history, anyway.
Yeah.
Go on.
Anyway. I think the first place that I go is that nations are kind of a vague concept anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And what does it really mean for a nation to exist in the first place? Like, I don't know if I can say that nations exist at all, really, philosophically. And if they don't exist philosophically at all, then they certainly don't have a right to exist. And I guess the next place is like, okay, well, if they exist conceptually to us, if we're going to use nations as a shorthand for something that we can say exists, then... Okay, does any particular nation have a right to exist? I still don't think so. Really, I think it comes down to the game that nations play is recognition.
Mm-hmm.
A nation doesn't exist unless other nations recognize it, and it's sort of this chicken and egg problem.
Yeah, and here's a great opportunity for us to do our almost weekly CGP Grey video reference.
Okay.
He has an interesting video about this called How Many Countries Are There? Or something to that effect.
Okay.
Where he tries to answer the question, how many countries exist? And he addresses the problem the same way you did. What is a country? And a lot of people, I think, use the term nation and country interchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
And he even addresses the potential difference between the two. Because he asks questions like, what about enclave nations? Like in the United States, we have several enclave, and they're literally called nations, like the Cherokee Nation of American Indians. Okay. Do they count or not? What's the boundary?
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of comes to a similar conclusion. There are definitions about what makes a country, but you're right. At the end of the day, who gets to decide whether something or a place is a country? Because countries are places.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's maybe the one delineating factor from a nation to a country. Nations don't necessarily have to exist in a single place.
Yes.
For example, throughout human history, there were nations of people that were entirely nomadic.
Yeah. Even then, I think you can dispute whether countries exist in a place because... Like, I assume that what you're saying is that a country exists in the place that whoever controls it claims that it does.
True.
But there's such a thing as disputed territory.
Right. But I guess what I'm talking about is diasporas.
Yes.
Of people. And this gets kind of tricky because certain diasporas of people claim, even though they are of another country, they have a right to exist as a nation, not necessarily on, like, they don't necessarily claim the land. They're like, this country can have this land, but when it comes to me, you don't. And we're kind of verging back on people here, but as a group, they say we have a group identity that entitles us to our own, like, and we have the right to exist as this group. And because we do, it's on the same level of authority as the group that claims to just own this land,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'll cite the American Indian example for that. They have special rules where they live, and they have exceptions to rules because they are a nation that has rights beyond the individual. But individuals inherit those rights being members of that nation, even though they're not a country. But they also have all the rights entitled to them by the country, which is interesting.
Yes.
So I think for the sake of this discussion, we may not necessarily need to even tie this to geography. It's because what is a nation if not for its people?
Right.
You know, and we saw this during the colonial era, you know, the whole boomer sooner, Sooners is what they're called. That's a little bit after. That's a little after the colonial era, I guess. Getting your people to go live in a place so that it's pretty much yours.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Americas, the game, you can say all you want. Oh, well, I, Britain, claim everything from here to as far west until something else that has already been claimed. It's on a map we recognize, essentially. That's how they put it. Because even though we had an idea about how big the world was, you know, how big the actual planet of Earth is.
Right. The Europeans who were colonizing did not actually know the shape of North America.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny, too. You can see this crop up in modern geography. There are certain places on a map where it's like, my favorite one is in the United States map. There's this big flat section north of like Montana, Wyoming, but there's a little notch in the top. But after that, it's flat. And it's because if you go back and look at these maps from like the 1800s, 1700s, it's got the coastline of the East Coast and then just straight lines that shoot off into the distance with no detail in them. They're like, we just assume it just keeps going straight, good enough for the map that we have. But when it comes to claiming territory, you just kind of say everywhere that way.
Right. It was another one of history's hilarious can kicks, where it's like, we don't really know what's out here, but we assume it goes something like this. None of us live there right now, so who cares? That's future somebody's problem.
Right. But we own it, though.
Yes. But we own it, though. So when you get there, then you can figure out what we own.
Yeah.
Here's the guideline. Yeah.
Right. But even then, that all kind of comes back down to recognition. And it's also kind of similar when you look at individuals when it comes to property. If you were to look at it from a land way, I'm sitting here drinking out of a can of drink and it's my property. But why? You know, we've kind of had this discussion before. I might have a right to this, but largely socially, property exists as a way for us to all agree on what is yours and what is mine. And we all agree that there's this idea that people are entitled to certain things. Like, you can be entitled to a thing.
Yes.
And you may even have a right to own that thing, mm-hmm. to have that entitlement. And so we all respect that because I don't want you just taking my things. And I don't want, and so in order to preserve that, we're going to kind of make this agreement.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I don't want you to take my things, so I will agree not to take your things.
Right. And that contract simultaneously between me and everyone in my general area, and then everyone in my general area to me, forms this web that of constraint that I might be at a disadvantage. I might be powerless to stop you from taking my thing right now. But there's always a bigger fish. You may be powerful enough to take my thing from me, but you may not always. So it's easier to say, look, I didn't take your thing when I could have, and we consider that fair, right? And there's like this...
Yes, and then you can get everybody else on your side when it comes to getting your thing back or otherwise exacting revenge. I mean, justice.
Yes.
On that person.
Exactly. So similar thing with the countries, I guess, to use that word. And that's usually when you see this crop up, though, I think. The vast majority of the time when you hear someone say, like, hey, does this country exist? It's like, okay, where is it? And what lands does it claim to hold? Does anyone else have claim? And that's where border disputes come in. And that's usually, like, one of the biggest things. Like, I mean, we can go ahead and I guess there's a giant elephant in the room about this that's been going on since, I guess, Sykes-Picot, that whole discussion about who gets the land modernly known as Israel, even though there was a country there before with people in it.
Who said they were from that country.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But I guess other people decided Sykes, but no.
Right. But this is Israel, though, so we're going to live here.
Yeah. Another hilarious one is how the world just collectively ignored that the mainland China didn't exist as a country for a while or was represented by the island of Taiwan when there were two Chinas in the UN. And there was the real China, and then there was the China everyone agreed that was China, even though one held over like 90% of the land mass under its control, and I would assume a similar proportion of the population.
And the other one was China.
And the other one was China. But yeah, you're right. It's all about recognition, you know. What's a country? Well, it depends on what everyone says is a country, or enough people. Enough people with enough influence. Because that's the other thing, too. Back to the China example is the best one. There might be over a billion people in a place that says it's China, where there's just a couple, maybe million people in the other place. But if the country that has all the guns that just helped win the World War decides that the small one is China, it doesn't matter how many people are in big China from the global perspective. And that's another thing, too. It's kind of a matter of perspective. I don't think that the average peasant farmer in China cared that UN thought that Taiwan was China at that time. Didn't matter to them. If you're in a country, if you're in a place with a government that is unchallenged or unrivaled within its borders, it's effectively the country for you. But for everyone else outside of it, it's just a place on a map, you know. And that's a weird thing to think about, is that, you know, we all kind of assume everything, you know. If you live in a country that is a pretty well established country that's been around for a while and the borders have kind of settled and everyone's kind of in agreement as to, like, oh yeah, this is the USA, this is Canada, this is Mexico, here's the cleared border lines. We fought over them / bought, sold parts of them over time, but we kind of settled on these lines on the map being what matters. And we probably have built structures to kind of mark these places in real life as well. It's pretty weird to think about places where it's like, where are you? Well, that depends. Who are you asking? Like, who's asking? I think the breakup of the USSR is an interesting example of that. So the Ukraine SSR, which is what it was called at the time, is it Ukraine? That's just the name of this region. We're in the USSR. We're in the United one, though. But to all the people that have lived there long before it was called that, it's just Ukraine still. And realistically, it depends. Are you a soldier from Moscow asking me what country I live in, and you might kneel me down next to a ditch if I say the wrong thing? Well, yeah, I'm gonna tell you I live in the USSR, but when I'm talking to people I've known my whole life in the same geographical area, it's still Ukraine to us. Like, what you call it's irrelevant. It doesn't change my daily life, what you call it. But so how does that kind of, I guess, manifest into rights for you? Because the first thing I normally think about when I think about, do nations have rights, or do governments have rights, do countries have rights, my first thought always comes to, like, that meme where governments don't have rights.
Yes,
people do.
Another place where I was thinking when it came to the aspect of recognition is that if you're going to say, okay, well, so-and-so, a nation has a right to exist, and it's, and its existence is dependent on others' recognition of its existence, then you're, you are claiming to have a right to the way other people think about you.
Yeah.
And you don't.
Which is kind of how we ended our discussion yesterday, that that's kind of the same thing when it comes down to individuals. You have a monopoly on the way you see yourself. Because you are the only person in you.
Yes.
Usually. Usually.
don't think too hard about
that one. Don't think too hard about that one. There's another good CGB radio video, yes, about that, but we're not going to go down that rabbit hole. The You Are Too video. But yes,
that one is fantastic, though.
It is fantastic. However, you, A, cannot have the perspective of anyone. You cannot have a third-person perspective of yourself. It's impossible. You can get a simulation of what that might be, yeah, like, but you...
But not really.
But not really. And this kind of reminds me of something I heard today, talking about memory, and I promise it ties together. It was a discussion about how unreliable memory is, and it's because you, the person who made the memory, made it with the perspective you had at the time. However, we never recall memories from that perspective. We always recall them from the present perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And with the way we believe memories work, like biologically, the shape of your brain has changed since the last time you thought about that thing. So it actually is different. And, but for the sake of your sanity, you think it's the same.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine that times multiple people. I have a different brain shape than you do. Also, I can never be occupying the same space as you at the same time. So my perspective of you will always be a little different at best and super different at worst than your perception of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to recognition, there's like that whole meme of like, do you even recognize yourself in the mirror? You know, trying to be dramatic, I suppose. But do you ever need to recognize yourself?
Not usually.
Not usually. No, doesn't usually matter. However, other people have to recognize you every day, or it benefits them to be able to if they know you.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think it's kind of funny how you have some control over your identity. As in, you can change yourself, which will have an effect on how others perceive you. But because you don't know exactly how they perceive you, there might be unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
A great example is names.
Yes.
So, I don't know about you, but everyone I've ever met so far that I've had this discussion with, there's a few names that they would never name their child that has nothing to do with the actual pronunciation, spelling of that name. Mm-hmm. But there's that one kid that had that name. That name has been, that is owned by that person in your head because you knew that person with that name.
Yeah. And it is now tainted to you.
And it is tainted to you. So you will never name your child that. But that bias also applies to everyone else who has that name now. But that's only in your perspective. And anyone, I guess, who knew this other person, if they had a similar experience.
Mm-hmm. And didn't know somebody else who was much nicer by that same name.
Mm-hmm. First. Then that's the
important part. Not always first.
Not always first, but more.
That can be undone with lots of time, but yeah.
Right. But if you're basing your initial interaction with someone and it's tainted by the name, it can be enough sometimes where you never give that person a chance to rectify that, you know, potentially. And what's funny, the funniest thing about that is you did not give them that name and they did not give themselves that name.
Right.
But it holds information for you. Their parents gave them that name and you likewise are choosing not to give your kids that name. And that name is useful just as a way to single you out from the others. Mostly. And that's why nicknames exist. I am a firm believer that nicknames arose I don't know this, again, this is pure conjecture on my behalf. I think it was a convergent evolution of a way to express a new level of familiarity in the way you recognize someone, and I know two people with the same name, but I need to differentiate them. Those two things together convened nicknames.
Right. Yeah. I'm thinking mostly the latter there. This happened as people became less creative with names, it seems, over time.
Religion will do that to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So with that, you know, when you have, you know, how many people in this town are named John, or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. You need some other way to differentiate them. And in adult life, we do this with surnames, but even then you can find how many John Smiths are in this city. A lot more than most other names, combination of names. So we have middle names that we have to differentiate them more on paper, but nobody actually knows anybody else's middle name usually.
Yeah.
That's really just a paper records thing. And then now we match with all kinds of other data points. Like, okay, you are the John Adam Smith born on. And
exactly.
We have nicknames because you and I are not going to go through that level of detail, you know, because I know somebody else who has your same first name. We're not going to start going through all these. We're just going to come up with another name to call each other.
Right. Quick side note on that. I do think it's interesting how different cultures do this. Family lineage just seems to be fairly universally important. There's some idea of a surname, be it how it's placed, sometimes different. Like I believe in some, like in Korean culture, it's the name you often go by is the one that's placed first is the surname.
Mm-hmm.
Like if your name is Park, that's usually, or Moon, those are like two I think somewhat common, I guess.
I'm not going to claim to have any knowledge of common names.
This is coming off of a perspective of a Westerner, so give me a break if it's not. But those are typically like, yeah, why are there so many, well, going to engineering school, that I had a lot of people from two distinct places in the world that were foreign exchange students to where I went to school for engineering, and that was from Asia and the Middle East. And there were a lot of Parks in that class, but they never went by that. But the way that it translates is they do last, first, middle, I think, something to that effect. But when you take that way of naming and you put it in a westernized, you know, database, well, the last name ends up where the first name should be. And then the first name ends up where the last name should be. And the middle name ends up where the last name should be. And so on the like roll call record, it's a bunch. The reason you have a bunch of Park Ilson or whoever, it's because, well, they just read their name off one sheet to the other without thinking about, oh, we need to switch these around to actually give the more unique, you know. And also in Latin America, or at least in Mexico, I don't want to extend this to all of Latin America, but I know for a fact in Mexico, there's a certain schema to the way a name is made. You have your given name, which is usually a fairly common name because, again, creativity with names and the influence of Catholicism will do this to you. But then it's something to the effect of your mother's last name, then your father's last name, and like, I think it goes back one more generation sometimes, depending on how formal you want to get. But that combination usually is not the same. So it's achieving the same goal. But taking this back to nations.
Yes, you know, we're way off track.
We're kind of way off track. But the point I think exists is that with nations, it's the collective peer pressure equivalent of, but it's the collective peer pressure equivalent, but also done internationally. And I do feel like this was a lot harder to do when communications were slower and people didn't travel as much. So let's take Rome, for example. There were some people in Rome who did travel a lot, but the average Roman citizen didn't. Their knowledge of the world was fairly limited. So when the Roman government said, oh, this place, most people just went, okay, like if you say so. They don't think about the people who live there, or they assume that they're just like them, you know. So are we going to recognize that place as a distinct other entity for the sake of that's who we're going to go conquer or whatever? Sure. Okay. But now, internationally, it's a little bit different. Most people have seen a map. It's actually kind of fascinating to witness people who haven't. I have this terrible addiction to reaction channels that I will go off on binges on every now and again. But one of my most recent favorite ones is they're not uncontacted, but they're as close to uncontacted maybe as you can get. They're in like remote isolated villages in certain parts of the world, like I think in like Turkmenistan or something like that, or Afghanistan or Pakistan or something like that, where they are shown and have never seen a map of the world before, but they know about certain places, particularly the United States, because we get involved all over the place. Weird. But they know that this place exists. They know their neighbors because they maybe have met someone from there, or they've heard about somebody who knew somebody who was from there, because if you're close enough, there's going to be some intermingling.
Yes.
But they're like, did you know that there's this place called France? They'd be like, no.
What's that?
Yeah. What's a France? You know, what does a French person look like? What do they sound like? And I think that's the other thing too. Countries also tend to somewhat align with culture.
Yes.
And that's way more, good example. It's really hard to tell, like, what does a French person look like without getting canceled?
I don't know if there's a way to talk about the French without getting canceled.
Fair enough. But the point I'm trying to get is, can you really say what the average French person looks like? Like, you could probably take an aggregate and get an average, but.
Right. My mind immediately goes to a stereotype of a French person. Yeah.
Yeah, an aggressively French person.
But you've picked an example that's impossible to not go there, so.
Sure. Every time. But you're right. But what's the standard deviation going to look like from that average, that aggregate? Probably pretty high.
Yes.
But if I say.
Right, because people from all over have gone to France and have moved there.
Yeah, it happens. But. There are one quick way to maybe figure it out. Do they speak French?
Mm.
That's usually a fairly good indicator of where, whether they're French or not, or have been French at one point, because France did have colonies.
Tragic.
But language is more of a cultural thing than it is a country thing.
Yes.
But you also see weird times when culture can actually, like, when you have too many cultures within the same country, it can have a problem. Even very similar cultures, i.e. Germany or the Germanic states, or remember Prussia, you know, the cat herding that was the Holy Roman Empire.
Oh my goodness.
All Germans for the most part, kind of, sort of, but not really, didn't want to be together, but to an outsider, they may have been pretty culturally the same. It depends on your relative scale. You know, if you're from China back then and you were to somehow make your way into Bavaria versus the Rhineland, I don't know very much about the German subcultural groups. I know that Bavaria is one of them, and I know the Rhineland is a place. So I'm just going to say that. You might look at those two groups of people and go, yeah, these are the same people to me, because they're so different from you that the distance apart from each other is minimized. But to someone who's from France, you might be able to tell the difference, right? But I think that kind of comes back to that recognizability. Like, if you can look at this group of people and say, yeah, you all kind of look like you belong together, not literally maybe look together, but like you behave similarly, your customs are similar enough, you can coexist somewhat peacefully. Yeah, we can call you a nation of people. And I think that also kind of translates to how it looks in the United States. When you cross into an Indian reservation, it's obvious a lot of the time. You know you've done this. So much so, like, the demographic changes. Most people in Oklahoma, I'll put it that way, you can tell who's of European descent in Oklahoma and who ain't most of the time. Let me put it that way. And when you cross into an Indian reservation, it's starkly different. You all of a sudden, and for those who don't know, population-wise, those who are recognizably Native American Indian, that's a very small percentage of the U.S. population. Very, very small. I think it's like around 1%, maybe less, probably less. And so if you were to spread them out evenly, you might come across one in a couple hundred, that look noticeably different if you were just doing it on looks. But when you go to these reservations, it's, whoa, there's a bunch of you here. Like, something's clearly different about this place. Also, a lot of them still preserve a lot of their cultural markings as far as, like, their color schemes that they use. Their art style is different than like, European traditional art style, even down to, like, and some of them still preserve their languages, and they will have certain signs that are still written in that language, or their flags. Flags are another good one. I think flags as a symbol are all about recognition, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And nations are more likely to have flags than just countries, you know? Like, look at the United States. We feel like everything needs a flag, you know?
Yes.
There's a flag for every state of every one of the 50 states. There's sometimes flags for, like, groups of people within that state. Even if they belong to a national organization, each of those groups have their own flag, you know. Now, that's interesting to think about.
Flags.
Flags.
How do they work?
How do they work?
Magnets. How do they work?
But I think that just flags are just that. It's a symbol that kind of you tie that identity to, you know. Like, most people in the world have seen an American flag, and they have an opinion about it. It may be a very minor opinion, but you know what it is, probably. And I can name off a couple of flags if I was shown them, you know. Even the confusing ones that are just three colors and bars that are very lame and boring, you know. Looking at you, most of Europe.
Yeah.
And sometimes they are used to communicate more. Like, look at the difference between the Russian Federation flag and the Soviet flag.
Mm-hmm.
Soviet flag had a message on it.
Yes.
And it's a fairly obvious one. Some are a little bit more esoteric. Like, I never knew what the color, like, why is Germany's flag red, yellow, and black? And why are they in that order? There's a reason. It's just so esoteric that, unless you were told what it was, it's not going to mean as much.
Yeah.
Yeah,
flags involve some of the biggest stretches in symbolism that I've ever heard of.
You know, I think the U.S. flag's pretty straightforward, but you got to know about the history.
You still have to know about the history, yeah.
Right. Like, why are there 50 of these stars?
Well, yeah, there's 50 stars, one for every state, and then there's 13 stripes for the original 13.
Yeah.
That's it.
And why do we use the colors that we use?
They were the colors on the Union Jack. That's why.
Pretty much. Like, the aesthetic of red, white, and blue, we borrowed straight up from,
yeah,
you know, stepdad Great Britain, I guess. I guess. I don't know if that flag was the same back then. I don't know enough about that history, but that kind of thing happens. I mean, it's also apparently pretty common. I mean, what, the French flag is those three colors. The Belgian flag, maybe, is it the Dutch flag is similar. The Russian flag is also red, white, and blue, just in a different order.
And a slightly different blue.
Oh, dude.
Shall we talk about the different blues? No.
We shall not.
We shall not talk about the
different blues. There's probably going to be a CGP Grey video made about it at some point. You can watch that. But I guess all this being said, like, I guess, say we did have a way to definitely agree, like, we had to take a poll, and if enough people agree to the poll, we can say that this is a country, right? That doesn't seem to me like a right, though, at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, if you had the right to exist, well, and then who gets to decide? You know? That's another interesting one. Right now, it's all external, right? The people of that country don't necessarily get to decide whether they are a country or not. It's everyone around them getting to decide. Now, you have influence over this, just like I might want to go by a nickname from here on out. Like, have you ever had that happen? Somebody change their nickname, or, like, if they want to start going by a nickname, and they want to, and you have to make that adjustment of referring to them a certain way, and then they insist that you call them by something else, and then from that point forward, it's like, you know, I had a friend who, he had some kind of life-changing event in his life. I think he went to anger management or something. I don't remember.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. He had, like, he was one of those troubled kids growing up, but his parents sent him to, like, some summer camp or whatever. I don't know if it was religiously oriented. Whatever. I just remember saw him in May when summer started, and then school reconvened in August.
And when he came back, he had a different attitude and he wanted to be referred to by a short version of his name. I'm just going to use it. His name was Andrew, but he wanted to go by Drew after that.
Okay.
Sure. But for it was so hard to start calling him that because I'd known him for years as Andrew.
Right. That's Andrew. Yeah.
That's Andrew. Yeah. And even though he, if you believe that he gets to decide that name, does that mean he can place a burden on everyone else around him to use a different name, you know?
And the answer is yes,
sort of.
In one way, but not another. Like, philosophically, no, he can't command you what to say. But socially, if you refuse to call him Drew, he's just not going to be your friend anymore.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. He's setting a new criteria for social proximity.
You have to do this or I won't like you anymore. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's what that is.
Or maybe a scenario we all can recognize. Have you ever been given a nickname that you didn't give yourself that you don't like?
Yes.
Probably, and I'm using the term nickname here.
Generously.
It's, you know, if someone's making fun of you and they come up with a very creative way, a good slogan for it, man, that'll stick. And you didn't get to pick that. And no matter how hard you insist, man, people will still use it.
You can't really make people not use it. Yeah.
Especially kids.
Oh, goodness.
Brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you really think about it.
Right. And it's only a criteria for your friends. Your friends will not call you that name because they know you hate it.
Right.
But no, there's no rules for anybody else.
Yeah. And I feel like with nations, it's the same thing, but scaled up. I'm trying to think of a country that had an... Oh, I just did. So, Rhodesia's not a place anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What is it called now? Zimbabwe?
I don't know.
Is that the same thing? Okay. If you have a map that is newer than like 1980s, 90s, I can't remember when the Rhodesian Bush War was. Somewhere in there. One of those funny little apartheid communism complicated wars happened in Africa. There was a country referred to as Rhodesia, and then it came under a new government, and that new government did not like that name because it did not give itself that name. It was given that name by settlers, essentially, or colonists. So, they instead wanted to be called, I'm pretty sure it's Zimbabwe. I could be wrong. I might be showing my ignorance here. Not the point, though, for illustrating the point, what I'm trying to say. But it didn't matter because there are still some people who will use the term Rhodesia. If you do that in that country, that'll get you looked at with a very jaundiced eye. But through peer pressure, eventually it changed, you know. And that's kind of what it all is. But I think all that to say, peer pressure isn't a right. I don't think that any country has the right to exist necessarily. I think that it's just one of those, I think it's more of an occurring phenomena, really, where enough people get together and either by the complacency of their neighbors, the other potential motivations of their neighbors, or sometimes fighting a war over it. In like in Rhodesia's case, there was a war fought about this where the people who did not like that country wanted it to be something else and they fought a war, and that's a pretty good way to make your name stick. Like most revolutions, you can call yourself whatever you want when you win that war and you're able to maintain yourself, you know?
Yes. And this goes back to the, if we want to go back to the school nickname example, one way you can get somebody to stop calling you that name that you don't like is to punch them in the mouth.
Yep.
There will be other consequences that follow from that, but you'll send a message.
Yep. You might have to hit a few people in the mouth, but eventually those mouths will stop moving in the way that you want them. Yeah. You know, in the mm-hmm. way that you don't like. But like you said, you might get a different nickname or the perception will change, but in the end, you have to convince other people to recognize you. And that's how it's played on the world stage today. Even if nations break up and balkanize willingly, there's kind of a pause in the global community where it's like, we had an agreement with the old government. Is one of you that old government?
Or right.
Well, and
just who exactly are we dealing with now?
Who are you? Like, yeah. And that's another fascinating thing, just as a quick aside about countries, is what is the country, the people or its government? Mm-hmm. And for most of global politics, it's actually the government. It's actually the government.
Yes.
Which is very interesting when the government is severely out of line with its people, which happens in dictatorships a lot.
And also everywhere else.
And everywhere else, but it's, I think, most obvious in dictatorships.
Yes.
Good example, North Korea. North Korea goes to the UN, I'm pretty sure. They send people there to do business, I guess, or to rant about stuff because they, you know. But either way, those people who get sent there are probably not the average person. The government gets to decide, but there's this weird... Or another good example is if you've ever tried to get documents to transition between one government to another. Like, say, for example, I want to become a citizen of a different country. You're starting from scratch. That government has no track record of you. How do they know your name is what you say it is? How do they know your government says that your name is what you say it is? You know, because... Let's just use an example. I'm coming from Mexico into the United States. Okay. The United States has a good enough relationship with the country of Mexico to know certain people that they trust, but trust is kind of handed, you know, like a good example. If I know who owns a house right now, if I know my neighbor and my neighbor comes down and says, hi, I'm moving, and then shows me the new person who's going to live there. Okay, I know you and trust you, and you're now imparting your goodwill onto this new person.
Yeah, giving them your blessing, yes.
Yeah, and okay, good deal. But if I just saw some random person I've never seen before walking around my neighbor's house, I might give pause at that, because I don't know you. Why are you here? You know, what happened to so-and-so? And if they say, I bought their house, I might be kind of skeptical. You might squint at that a little bit. So I think that's kind of how it goes as well with governments. Like, I think that's why ambassadors are a thing. Like, I actually, back in the day, it's kind of how I guess it had to be done when correspondence was traveling at the speed of horse. So who are you? Well, I'm the guy from, like, when ambassadors would change out, like, the old ambassador would go with the new one and say, hi, you recognize me, and you recognize me because you recognize the guy before me, and... There's just a chain of us that have existed that have passed this goodwill on to know that we're official and legit. But governments kind of play that different game, though, really, when you think about it. Like, who cares about what countries exist? Who cares the most, you know? The people of that country and the government are usually the two people who care the most about whether or not another country exists. And mm-hmm. Governments don't have rights either, so... We have one more aside on here, unless you have anything else you want to talk about when it comes to countries and nations. Nope. Living things. So here's your bonus segment we didn't talk about going into this, because we have a little bit of time left. I don't think we can justify a full episode out of it. There is a weird obsession that human beings have, and I think we talked about this a little bit before, about feeling really bad when a species goes extinct.
Yes.
But that happens a lot anyway.
Yes, has happened for basically ever.
Yeah. And I can kind of understand it, I guess, if it's our fault.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's when people feel the worst about it.
But at the same time, no other animal feels bad when they make another animal go extinct.
No, but you could also make the case that other animals have no way of knowing that they've actually done that.
What?
Like, if a frog eats the last of a particular type of insect, it doesn't know that it's just done that. For all it knows, there's millions more of them.
Yeah, but if there's only one of an insect left, it's already extinct pretty much anyway.
Sure.
But I guess what you're saying is, like...
Animals know when they kill something, but they don't know that they've killed the last of it.
But that's not even what I'm talking about. It's the problem started long before that.
Sure.
So, like, let's take an invasive species. Frogs are a good example. I believe there's some species of frog that's, like, not indigenous to, like, Australia or something, but it became a huge problem. Maybe it was something
else. Sure, that's believable.
Naturally. Yeah, those frogs aren't aware of their own pop. They don't see themselves as a population, I don't think, either.
No.
Like, most animals are not aware of their diaspora, I guess, like...
Right, they're aware of themselves, and then if they're a social species, then they're aware of their immediate social group.
Right. They don't have any grasp on, like, their global impact.
No.
At all. Or even, like, sometimes their biosphere impact, because that can sometimes be beyond what they can see. Because they don't, animals also don't comprehend why it might be bad if you ate all of your prey, even though it's very obvious to a human being. If we killed all the cows and ate all the cows...
We'd have no more.
We have no more cows to eat.
Forever.
Forever. So we probably shouldn't do that. And we don't.
Right, but most animals, yeah, animals usually do not have forethought like that.
But let's take it to a creature, okay, let's take it to a creature that's gone extinct relatively recently. There's some breed of pigeon that went extinct in the U.S.
Okay.
Or how about bison? That's one that's not extinct yet.
Mm-hmm.
Almost, though, not for lack of trying.
Yeah, easily could have been.
Easily could have been.
But we stopped it at one point.
Do bison have a right to exist, though? Do species have a claim to not going extinct?
Because I don't think so either. we do sometimes extend rights to other creatures, or we do so in like a social pseudo way. Pets are a great example mm-hmm. of animals that we have then like extended rights as our property to.
Yes.
But we kind of seemingly do that with all species to a degree, except when we don't like them because they're in our house and we call someone literally called an exterminator.
Yes, to kill them.
To kill them, and we pay them money to do that. Yeah, funny how that works. Save the whales, but, you know, burn the ants and spiders. because they don't look like us. Like,
they're ugly.
They're ugly. And scary, and get everywhere, and bite me, and stink.
And so I will not feel bad about spraying them with horrific poison.
Yeah. Yeah, so what's funny to me is looking at, like, so Bill Gates, being as wealthy as he is, as bored as he is, has decided to make his mission in life to just cease malaria from existing, mm-hmm. which is also a living thing, but we don't care, malaria sucks. So, right,
yes, please get rid of that.
And I feel like most people would be okay if mosquitoes went the way of the dodo, too. Like, yeah, what if we just killed all the mosquitoes and never had to deal with mosquitoes again? Most people would be like,
I'm on board. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sign me up. Where do I donate?
Where do I join the anti-mosquito force? Yes.
Right. We have no problem. Literally, is it genocide at that point? Is it genocide at that point? Or is it like speciesside or... What would you call that?
I don't know. It doesn't matter. It
doesn't matter. But, yeah, I don't know. I agree. They don't have the right to exist. I think, too, that to say so is potentially harmful as well.
To say that they do?
Yeah. I think there's a certain arrogance that you have to have in order to say that other animals have rights or that we should, like... Hopefully this is not going to jump off onto too much of a deeper topic, but, like, to think that we are so special that we know better and like need to intervene on another animal's or another species' behalf. That kind of drives me up a wall. It really does. Mm. Like, and take a species that should be extinct, you know, like the dodo, for example.
Well, they are extinct.
Yeah. We could have stopped it though. We shouldn't have.
Let's look at a different case.
Okay.
Let's talk about, okay, this is not a species, but a breed that only exists because of us.
Chihuahuas, let's talk about it.
I was going to say pugs.
Oh, yeah, pugs are worse. At least chihuahuas are, like, genetically viable and don't live lives of suffering.
Right.
All you pug owners out there breeding suffering for joy.
Have you listened to your dog breathe?
Nope, but I've listened to it try.
Let me just go on a one sentence rant. Why do you want a dog that looks like it's been smacked in the face with a frying pan?
It's ugly cute. It's a thing. It's like, there's this other side of the uncanny valley where something becomes so repulsive that it's cute again.
Yeah, sorry, that's objectively wrong.
It's actually, okay, at me, it's not, though.
I agree that such a phenomenon exists.
Yes.
People who like it are objectively wrong.
Okay. You know that phenomenon exists for humans, too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe we should talk about that next week. We're going to talk about how ugly you are. Yeah, I don't know. To me, I can understand. Let's just call it like it is. We want to prevent species from going extinct when it benefits us, and we don't when it doesn't. And there's also a certain amount of hubris in saying that we understand the global ecology well enough.
Yeah, I think that's maybe a reason to be more hesitant about allowing species to go extinct, is that we don't understand the ramifications it will have on the global ecology. So the more we can just keep things the same, the less risk we're taking with that. I think that's probably the most rational way you could look at it. If you're trying to just be an animal conservationist where, you know, we need to do, even if it comes at great cost in other ways to us, not allow things to go extinct because we're messing with the ecology in way. We're turning dials and we don't know what other dials they're connected to.
Yeah, but we're also turning dials by keeping them alive, is my point.
Mm-hmm.
If a species is outcompeted...
Yeah, this is when it matters. Why are they going extinct?
Yes.
Are they going extinct because of us? In which case, we're the ones turning the dials. But if they're going extinct because they're just not a viable species and they're being outcompeted by other stuff, then that's just how it was going.
Yeah. We need to talk about climate change at some point.
Yes.
I'm going to footnote that because I don't want to go down that road because that cannot be covered.
That will be an episode or more.
Yeah, that cannot be done in the last 10 minutes or so of this.
Yeah, no.
But no, I agree. So, how do we kind of summarize this up with what we talked about last time? Because last time, we kind of said that people do have the right to exist.
Mm-hmm.
What makes us so special that, because so far we've gone down the list of nations, countries,
and literally all other living things.
All other living things don't have a right to exist, but we do.
But we do.
Why?
And I think it's, I think maybe you could make the case that certain other animals as individuals may have the right to exist. In the sense that, like, it all depends on the moral standing of that animal, and this starts getting very subjective very fast, because all things to do with morality are wishy-washy subjective things when it really comes down to it. It's the reason we have the right to exist is because we consider humans to be ethically significant.
In a nutshell, we said so.
Yes.
And we're the only ones talking.
Right. So then, you can say, like, okay, so-and-so, an animal, is intelligent enough that I consider it to be ethically significant, and therefore it now has the right to exist.
Yeah. I'm okay with that. I think that's the most true thing about it. And the reason we kind of, nowadays, say that all humans have the right to exist, because it's not a terribly old concept, really.
No.
That's the darker side, I guess, of that to think about, is that I think ethical significance is a better way to put it. How do we collectively kind of average out the weight of ethical significance? Because I'm sure we haven't always applied it to everyone, but we kind of, and you know what? I think it's okay that the definition changes. I think it should be allowed to, because there could come circumstances where we need to be able to change, and to say that only humans is probably wrong, but only ethically significant things should. And ultimately it's going to come down to another conversation or so. Like, I think the last thing we'll talk about today, I guess, is we'll go back off into funny land of the weird world of sentient alien species.
Yes.
They're not people.
They are not.
But they might be ethically significant enough for us to extend rights to them.
Yes.
But not everyone might agree. We'll have to kind of decide.
Right. And yeah, you'll have people who hate them and just want to kill them. Yeah.
Yep. And it'll be kind of, I think, depending on what they look like and how we interact with them, it's going to be very similar.
Or how they behave toward us.
Exactly.
Maybe they're aggressive and we don't like them. And so now we've decided, well, if you're not going to respect us, we're not going to respect you. So we'll kill you.
Right.
Or try to.
Yep. You know, and I think if you look at, like, there are groups that exist that actually want to do that want to have that conversation about animals right now, like PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. That's literally what they're trying to do, is convince people that
animals are ethically significant.
Yeah. Yeah. All animals are ethically significant, but I think we all kind of realize that they're not, or it's inconvenient for them to be. I say they're kind of part of that.
That's, yes, interesting. That's where it starts to get kind of spooky.
Yeah. But I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. I think that should be another one for another time.
Do you have an opinion? Let us know which animals you think are ethically significant and why.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Are there any species you believe should be ethically significant? Or, like David pointed out, are there specific animals? Because I can tell you right now, I have 3 cats. One of them is ethically significant. No, I'm kidding. They're all somewhat ethically significant, but not equally. I can just tell you that right now, because it's true. Like, I've had that discussion with my wife before. If the house is burning down and you got 2 arms, you can only grab 2 of them. Which 2 do you get? Now, you don't obviously kick the other one into the fire. Like, you try to help it, but, like, you might leave the door open or something. But, like, which 2 do you grab first?
Sorry, bud. You're on your own.
Sorry, bud. Yeah. You know which one I'm talking about. You've met that one.
I do. I've met all of them.
You've met all of them. But I think you can understand the...
Yes, I do.
The hierarchy. Yeah. But...
See, 2 are ethically significant, but 1 is physically significant.
Golly. But yeah. So let us know what you think, because I think there's plenty of... This is one of those endlessly subjective conversations to have that is valuable to have, because... It might actually matter someday. We might actually need to come to a consensus at some point that's not just a soft consensus. We might need to be explicit in that, pragmatically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. I have nothing else.
I think I'm satisfied.
Philosophers.
Philosophers. If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.